Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go. Dr. Stone, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Never better. I'm super excited to have you on the show because I remember reading about you, I think it was 10 years ago, doing some research on, or not research, I think you discovered and invented how to do it, to basically rebuild someone like myself's knee that is in utter disarray after three ACL reconstructions. So there was, I believe that there was hope, and I was really excited when I saw your name and somehow we got connected, and I said, I've got to have this guy on because I want to hear if there's actually a future for my fitness and other people like me who aren't actually that old. So thanks a lot for joining.
Sure. My pleasure.
So can we jump into that and the research that you've done? You're well known and everybody tries to get into your office here in the Bay Area. And I know that because everybody's told me that. And a few people have been to you and had good success, but you've been an advocate, I guess, or really champion the idea that you don't have to have this, I don't know, you'll be better than I am, fake knee put in that only lasts so long, and the ability to actually have something that's natural, maybe not from a human, but another animal to reconstruct, if that's the right word, your knee so that you can, I guess, really have a better life.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're jumping all the way into it.
I'm jumping right into it because listeners want to go right into it, Dr. Stone. We can backpedal as we unfold the episode, but is there a future? Like, people want to know that. Like, it causes me anxiety. I went to an orthopedic surgeon here at Mid-Peninsula, who I'm not going to say their name, and she basically was like, you're done. She's like, your knee's done. You can't get a new one because you're too young. And like, there was like this long silence. And I'm like, where does that really leave me? I mean, luckily I went to Stanford Performance Lab and they retaught me how to walk through a study that I got into without having pain. And, you know, that's hopeful, but a lot of people are like me in that situation. So the answer to your question, yes, I'm jumping right in.
So to jump right in, 80% of people told that they need to have an artificial knee replacement don't. So they could either have a biologic joint replacement where we replace the meniscus cartilage, the shock absorber for the knee, or we regrow their articular cartilage, the bearing surface in the joint, or rebuild their ligaments, or a combination of all those things. Or they could have a partial joint replacement. And so most people who are told that they need a full knee replacement have usually only worn out one or two compartments of their knee, not all three compartments. And if it's not bone on bone, meaning if there's still some joint space, then they can have tissue put back in. If it's bone on bone, then we need to put in a bionic solution. But that bionic solution most commonly can be a partial replacement rather than a full replacement, which means that they preserve their ACL, they preserve the rest of the tissues, the joint itself feels much more natural. And these partial replacements have gotten so much better because we now use robotics and CT scans to build 3D models of people's knee joints and put the components in under robotic control. So everything about them has become so much better that it permits people to get back to full sports. And that's what's so novel about what's happened over the last number of years in joint reconstruction.
Now, I saw some examples where you actually had done this for professional athletes and they were back up and running, competing at the highest level. So this is possible for the average person as well.
Of course. Most people who wear out their knee are, as you said, average people. But we are fortunate to treat lots of very driven athletes who want to get back to doing extraordinary things. And so we did a partial replacement on one patient's knee on one side and a partial replacement in his other knee. And he just recently ran across the United States So did a 3,000-mile run on his partial knee replacements. And so the whole concept of go home and rest your knees and wait for your knee replacement, or you've had one and so now you should protect it, those concepts are kind of gone out the door, and we can spend time and talk about why that is.
Yeah, can we talk about that? I mean, it's scary. To be honest with you, if you're 50 years old and they tell you you can't have a knee rip, or they're not going to put one in because you're too young. And I think there's a lot of people in their 40s. I mean, you know this, their 40s and 50s, who their knees are just worn out. It's just from, I played lacrosse since I was in kindergarten. I mean, that just, it happens, right? And then you're sort of scared because they say, hey, you can't have the replacement because the replacement only had or last 10 years or something. And then you're like, okay, well, I'm going to be 65 or 62 or 60. And now, like, where am I? Am I losing my leg? I mean, you know, that is a scary thing.
Yeah. So that's why it's fortunate now that we can put back new tissues. We can put back the meniscus. The most common story is, hey, doc, I tore my meniscus in high school or college playing soccer or skiing or whatever. The doc went in, he took it out. I went back to sports. I did great for 10 or 20 years. And now I have knee arthritis. That's probably the most common story that we hear. And so when we look at that patient and look at their gait and look at their x-rays and their MRI, if they still have joint space, we can put a meniscus back in that knee and buy them another 10 or 20 years. If they have joint space, we can regrow their articular cartilage. Or again, if they've just collapsed on one side, we can do a partial replacement. So we think that every decade is precious. Life is short. There's no reason to live in pain. I don't think you should torture people and say, hey, go home and wait for your knee replacement or wait till you're older. I think every decade is precious. You know how you feel when you miss a few days of workouts, when you're addicted to that working out. And I think many people feel that way.
Can you explain a partial? I have a friend who, I think he's 47, 46, and he told me he had a partial knee replacement. What does that really mean? What does that amount to? You're putting animal cartilage into that space and regrowing it with stem cells or something to that extent?
No. So what you're describing is more on the biologic side. And when we say partial knee replacement, we are on the bionic side, the artificial side. And so if you think about the knee as having patellofemoral joint where your kneecap rubs against the femur, or a medial femoral condyle, that sort of inside part of the knee, or a lateral femoral condyle, the outside part of the knee, any one of those parts of the knee, we can just resurface alone. So it's like capping a tooth rather than having an entire set of dentures. And so if you've got arthritis and you've only worn out one part of the knee, we want to just resurface that one part of the knee. And that's what we call a partial joint replacement. If you've worn out all of the knee, then we think about a full knee replacement. But even that has changed tremendously over the years. We now very rarely have to resurface the kneecap, and we almost never have to use joint cement anymore, the fixative that used to hold the implants in place. Because of robotics and 3D modeling, we're just so much more precise now that you can make the shape the bone to fit exactly into the implant, and the implant can have a porous undersurface where the bone can grow into it. And so after 6 weeks, the body has grown into this metal porous implant and it's fixed by your own bone. So we don't have to worry about you knocking it loose or the cement coming loose as you age. In fact, the more you exercise, the better you do, because you build bone by exercise. And that's exactly the way the new implants work. So the old days of telling someone that they can't run or they can't play singles tennis or they can't climb or ski with their joint replacement are really out the window now, because we can do these in a way that you really can't knock them loose. And there's no reason why you shouldn't go back to sports. And there's a lot of good reasons why you should, because impact sports and resistance sports are the number one way to build bone and build muscle. And the stronger the bone, the stronger the muscle, the more you protect that joint. And as you well know, the more you exercise, the happier you are. the more testosterone, pheromones, endorphins, all those good things are circulating, makes you happy, and happy patients do well.
Why are more doctors adopting this philosophy? I feel like you're, I don't mean out there, but you've been on the forefront of this for a while, and you still have this. I mean, is it the system that's what you check the box? Because I hate to say it, but that's what the insurance pays for. Is that the ease? Is it because these doctors aren't into that forward thinking? Like, what is it?
I think a lot of doctors are, and they're seeing more and more of these kinds of results. They're seeing the research that we present at meetings all over the world, and other doctors do as well. The whole field of regenerative medicine that we'll talk about some more in a minute, I'm sure, is growing so fast that we're realizing how much more the body can do. And quite frankly, I learned from my patients who cheat. Over the years, we told them, you know, don't do this or don't do that. And my patients would come back, you know, holding their crutches in their hand or holding their skis boots and saying, hey, doc, you told me I had to wait whatever amount of time, but I just really couldn't resist. And we learn from those patients, and we learn from the patients who push the limits of the things we thought you should or couldn't do. And patients teach us what you really can do. And so by working with the patients, by working with their biology, by adopting better techniques, for instance, robotics, we can be just much better at what we do. And sort of the fun of the sport that I'm in, the sport of orthopedic surgery, is that almost everything we touch, you can see ways to make it better. And the fun of it is that I'm excited to make all those things better. And each patient is truly unique. There's no such thing as a routine surgery, because patients come with different tissues, different perspectives, different anatomy. And our job is to design better and better techniques that apply to that individual patient and how they want to get back to sports and what their goals are. And that's really the exciting part of what we do.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting part time to be alive because, and you'll remember this, but the first time I had an ACL, I was 13 years old. I was, and at the time had a doctor on the East Coast who was, I think, on the forefront, so to speak, he was a very good orthopedic surgeon. And I was in a cast from my ankle to the top of my thigh for an ACL reconstruction for 6 months.
Yeah.
Literally for six months. And I learned to do a lot of cool things, Dr. Stone, on crutches. Like I can walk, I can do stilts, I can do all sorts, I can run. The third time I woke up in a machine and I think I was walking, like, to be fair, like really walking 72 hours. And now to talk to you when I'm not like completely done, that I can get like even revive myself again, it's incredible. And I think it opens up a whole world for people that they didn't expect. I want to ask this, and maybe you can't put a price on it, but is this something that's covered? Because people are listening to this probably are like, oh my God, this could change my, and I know you do this for, we're talking knees, because I think a lot of people have knees, but you do this for shoulders, and do you do it for hips and other joints too?
We treat shoulder, knee, and ankle here. We've developed the biologics around those three joints, and other people, of course, treat the other joints.
Is this is this comparable expense to the old alternative of whatever, this mechanical knee? Is it more expensive, or how's that all shake out?
Yeah, it shakes out differently for people because of their insurance programs. And different insurance programs, of course, reimburse differently for everyone, and which makes it impossible for us to ever figure out in advance. So, you know, we just help our patients build their insurance, and they get reimbursed whatever they get reimbursed by whatever program that they have. In general, though, the joint replacements, the partial and totals under robotic control, are the same pricing wise from the surgery centers and hospitals or whatever as the old fashioned kinds are. And in general, the tissues that we transplant, meniscus and ACL and other tissues, those come from AATB tissue banks. And I think most of the insurance companies are used to reimbursing for those sorts of things these days. much of the biologics that we use, whether it's PRP or HA, are now reimbursed by most insurance companies. So it varies all over the board. Our role is to figure out what the best thing to do is for the patient, and then we just help them bill their insurance company and see how it all falls out.
Yeah, I think it's, and look, at the end of the day, like, we'll be dead. So if you had to put some of your own money in and you bought yourself like a better 20, 30 years, I mean, I'm just a realist, like, it's worth it, because what is your health worth? So I appreciate you answering that. Well, let's jump into a little bit of the regenerative or slowing of aging. You wrote a book called Play Forever, where it sort of dives into that stuff. And while you do the ankles, shoulders, and knees, you have been always an advocate of this idea that you do get older, but it doesn't mean you have to degenerate. I think, like, I have some friends who are in their late 40s and they're like, I'm done. I'm like, you are not done. Like, what are we doing? Like, let's go ride the century. Let's go do the diabolical double again. Like, I think some of that is mindset.
Well, I have a grandmother who used to say, meat is done, people are finished. And so she was obviously a, you know, third grade teacher in New York City and lovely and that. But the concept is right. If you choose to feel that you're finished, you may be finished, but you don't, that's a choice you make. And we know now that we have patients can exercise well into their 90s. I saw a patient the other day who was putting on his wetsuit for his first windsurf at age 89. Fabulous story. He just said, you know, I've always wanted to try it, and here I am. And so really the mind controls so much of how we do and what we do. Our job as orthopedic surgeons is to really help you physically do all the things that you want to do, and encourage you mentally to stay active and to train and to try to avoid the injuries that are so painful for all of us.
What do you think are the things that people can do to get to be that 89-year-old who's going windsurfing?
Isn't that great? Really, it's attitude first. Just keep thinking about, as you mentioned, I wrote a book called Play Forever, you know, how to recover from injury and thrive. And so use the tools in that book, use the tools that you hear about so often, about training, about focusing on sports you love, about setting goals for yourself, about having fun. And so we often talk to people about not working out, but about playing out. And so taking your time in the gym, your time wherever you like to go, and looking at it as play time and adding more play and fun into your life. And when that's there, I think you want to do it forever. And that's what keeps you going.
Can you talk about actually some of the practical things? I don't think people understand some of this stuff. I got worried as a cyclist that I wasn't walking enough. And what I mean by that is the bone density. And I think people don't understand the biology of this stuff. So I went to a DEX scan and I was like, hey, look, I need to understand my bone density. And they're like, oh, you're in your 40s, you're fine. I was like, I might not be fine. I've been on my bike for 10 years because I didn't want to run on this knee. And if I'm not walking, it's possible. And I think professional cyclists in their 20s and 30s can experience this sort of stuff. And it's just so important to get out there on a daily basis. And I know it sounds like people will say it, but you really do need to, I think the 10,000 steps, Dr. Stone, was like made up by some marketing thing, but you do need to move. And the importance of that, there's biology behind it.
So what you're referring to is that there was a very good study looking at cyclists and their bone density. And it turns out when you're on the bike, it's not as much impact and resistance into your whole bone structure as you might think. Tremendous amount, of course, in the legs. But basically, your abdominal muscles are hanging down, your back is curved over, and bone densities in cyclists were not really great. And so it reminds you that the biology that you're referring to is that resistance exercise is the only way to build bone mass. And since all of us, as we're aging, women faster than men, are losing bone mass, and since the drugs for that are not great and all have side effects, it's so much better to add in resistance exercise, which means weightlifting, climbing stairs, hiking mountains, adding resistance to your sport is just the best way to build bone. Building muscle, you can do lots of ways, and all the ways we all enjoy doing weightlifting is the best because it combines that resistance exercise in a weighted position. But those are the two things that you can do to maintain body health through your 90s. And remember, our goal is to have you drop dead age 100 playing the sport you love. And so picking up new sports, one of the things we talk about in that book and to people all the time is about pick up a new sport every 6 months. And it doesn't have to be a whole new sport. It can be just a new activity and a new interest within your sport. But by doing so, you're using different muscles. You're taking on a different attitude. You're training all around. You're having fun in different ways. And that goal of, hey, I'm going to pick up something new in 6 months, in doing that keeps the whole game fun.
This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years' experience in the real estate and lending space, and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know, because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. Now back to the show. What are you most excited about right now? You see all the research, you see all the studies, you see things before it even hits the journal in this regenerative or slowing of aging, or the ability to sort of, yeah, slow down aging really is what it is. I'm trying to find the right word because I think you can turn back time. I mean, somewhat, right? I mean, but there's this age of where, like, I heard someone was regrowing their larynx or something with stem cells, and the ability to do that, like, that really could, I mean, what if you just regenerate your organs and things like that? That can extend our life in this new age of medicine.
So let me talk to you about that in several different ways. And so we have a public nonprofit research foundation called the Stone Research Foundation, where we have a number of studies going on there in this space. So we'll talk about first stem cells that you brought up in regenerating tissues, and then we'll go on to some of the others. So over the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of interest in injecting cells back into people's bodies for different kinds of injuries, and whether they came from the person's fat or their bone marrow, or they were grown cells in tissue culture. Many people went off to the Cayman Islands or Mexico to have their cells grown up. It turns out that most of those cells die pretty quickly after being injected. And very few of them actually do what we were hoping that they would do within people's bodies. However, it turns out that every one of us has billions of stem cells. Stem cells are perivascular cells. They live in the walls of vessels. When you have an injury, a recruitment factor goes out from your injury to your body's own stem cells. They divide, they create a daughter cell that is another stem cell, which is why they last forever. And they create a second daughter cell called a progenitor cell or stromal cell. That cell is the one that rushes to the site of injury and directs the whole healing response, and in so many different ways. And so we've now learned that if we can give you recruitment factors rather than cells, we can induce the billions of cells that you have in your body to respond to the injury that you have or the disease that you have. And so much of our research is around what are the most potent recruitment factors, which can we use, when do you use which one, and how can we induce and guide and accelerate healing in the best possible way. Most of your listeners will have had or have heard about PRP, where their own blood was taken and spun, the platelets release their own growth factors. And those growth factors are potent recruitment factors. One of the ways that PRP does work is by recruiting your body's own healing cells to that site of injury. And so we think this is the most exciting, growing, fastest growing space in this research area. Your body clearly does know how to do it. We all know that salamanders can regrow their tails. Our own children can regrow their fingertips at a certain age when they're young. And so we know that there are the DNA, the ability of cells to regrow tissues exists there. And our job in the science side of this world is to figure out how to unlock that regenerative power. I will tell you that nothing is growing faster than the fetus. And so birth tissues are our richest, most potent source of all of these growth factors that we want to use to stimulate growing. And for instance, one of the reasons why the mother does not reject the fetus, even though the fetus is only half the mom, is that the cells in these birth tissues are potently immunomodulatory, meaning they shut down the immunogenic response, the inflammatory response. And they're potently anti-fibrotic. They diminish scarring, and they're anti-inflammatory and antibiotic, and they're potently anabolic. They stimulate the healing of tissues. And so if ever there's a fountain of youth that we on the science side want to tap into, it's tapping into the use and the optimization of all of these birth tissues, which I'm certain will be added to almost every tissue transplant that people have in the very near future. The FDA right now is evaluating these products as a drug rather than as a device. And so much of the clinical application has been reduced until the FDA clears these products. And so it's okay to hold off. We're using the ones that we can use today. And certainly PRP is a potent tool. But coming down the pike, our ability to do a much better job of regenerating tissues and stimulating healing is on its way. In the Research Foundation, one of the things we're doing that you also alluded to is how do we help athletes get back to sports faster? How do we accelerate healing? So if you ask anyone who has a knee surgery, what was the worst thing about that experience? It's rarely the pain. It's almost always the atrophy that they get after surgery. And it takes them a year to come back from that atrophy if they ever come back. And so it turns out that when I hit you with an axe, otherwise known as surgery, you have a huge cortisol release, your body's natural stress hormone. And that hormone binds to your muscle receptors. And so that binding induces muscle atrophy within 8 hours. So those days when you were in a cast, or even when you waited 72 hours before you started exercising, that atrophy had already started to kick in. And so one of the research programs we have going on now, and we've just completed the safety trial of it, is can we block those receptors, block the cortisol from binding on those receptors and block that muscle atrophy? And we may be able to do this. We're looking to raise the money for the next 100 patients in that clinical trial. But I think going forward, it's another way in which we're going to be working with people's own biology in order to accelerate their healing.
Yeah, you know, when you said that, that was like the biggest deal. And it was really hard to get that muscle back. And it like disappears in a minute.
It does.
I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Is it true that you can exercise the other, I know this is a little off topic, but it's on topic that way. Is it true that if you exercise the other side of that limb, that it carries over to the other side in some benefit somehow? I never really understood that, but I did hear it.
Yes, it is true. There were a number of studies looking at that, and there was about a 30% crossover effect from exercising the non-injured leg. Unfortunately, it's not enough to stop the atrophy, but it's worth doing. So almost all of our patients on day one after surgery, let's just say you had your left knee operated on day one after surgery, you're spinning on a well-leg bike, we call it. Your left knee would be sitting on a chair, and your right leg spins on the bike in order to take advantage of that effect.
Does that, and that translates into muscle growth, which is, there's too much negative, but it is some positive effect, literally, like that?
Well, just think about when you're exercising, what are the things that are happening? You're increasing your circulating testosterone, your adrenaline, your endorphins, all the things that make you feel good. You're increasing your blood flow, all the potent things that are important for healing occur with motion and exercise. And all the negative things occur with stillness or bracing or casts. And so everything we can do to get the body exercising right away augments the healing, diminishes the atrophy.
In your estimation, which we are not going to quote you or hold you to, does this idea that you're, the study that you have going on, does this cut an ACL reconstruction rehab in half?
So it's, the question you're asking is, why does it take a year to come back from an ACL injury? Why does it even take Klay Thompson a year to come back?
Yeah, exactly.
Great athlete. What's going on here? So there's a host of factors that we can now start to have an action upon. Number one is, how fast can we get the cells to migrate into the new graft? How fast can we get the cells to lay down new collagen? How rapidly can we shut down unnecessary inflammation? How much can we diminish the muscle atrophy that occurs after injury or surgery? So every one of these components plays in together. And so our feeling is that once we're using all of these tools, we will be able to cut down ACL recovery times quite a bit, because we can accelerate that remodeling. We can help that tissue heal both faster and potentially stronger. And we can diminish the atrophy, and we can diminish the head effect of, oh my gosh, I've got to wait a year before I can come back and play.
Yeah, I mean, that when you think about that, it's crazy. I mean, that's all those professional athletes do. I mean, that is their job every day. They can do two sessions a day. They can do like sleep. They can do all crazy things, and they have access to it all, because it's all, every day they lose is a day of pay, and it takes a year. So if we could do that, that would be incredible. I do have another, people, listeners are probably like, how does he know all these things? Because I lived it my whole life. What about the electrodes that you can put on your muscles, electrical stimulation to basically stop the atrophy? Is that still a thing?
You know, we used to be extremely excited about electricity and other ways of stimulating muscle and bone healing. The enthusiasm kind of fell off quite a bit, because the efficacy, the amount of effect produced by those things was there, but it just wasn't great. And by the time you're done with cost and time, we'd rather have the patient doing other things that look like they'd be more beneficial. And so there was no negative except for time and cost. The benefit tended to be pretty small. And so better to have you exercising dynamically than doing anything passively that you're sitting there hoping something's going to make you stronger.
What do you think about, there's a lot of influencers online, Dr. Stone, who are saying that you can affect a lot of this by diet and supplements and everything. From my research, and I'm not a doctor. I do have a master's in psychology. I'm not a doctor, but I understand how to read some of these things. The only supplements I've really, that have real science that I can tell behind them, are caffeine, protein, and creatine, if we break that down. So a lot of this other stuff, other than just natural, like eating healthy, in your work, do you incorporate any of that, or have you seen any of this effect of diet on accelerating getting back into where you were before you had that injury?
So we'd agree with you on the supplements. We would add glucosamine there as well, because, you know, for 30 years, our patients have reported back to us that they feel less stiff. And almost everyone who takes glucosamine gets much harder fingernails. So we know that it is absorbed into the body, and it is utilized by the body and people, and it's a precursor to hyaluronic acid, a natural lubricant of the joint. And so people feel less stiff when they take glucosamine. However, back to your question on diet, you know, we're big fans of healthy diets, and healthy diets, you know, mean different things to different people, but essentially healthy food grown in the ground and unpackaged is a pretty good guide. And I think that the most important thing about diet is eliminating the bad things. And as you get rid of a lot of the fat and a lot of the unnecessary carbohydrate, you end up with a lean protein diet for most athletes. You increase your water content in your diet. You're generally on the right path. You figure out how to titrate your caloric intake to your exercise output. So you're eating what you need to fuel your body. You're optimizing your weight for your activity and your sport and your body size. And that can be very different for different people. And people know when they feel lean enough and strong enough to do the things they want to do. So we're very liberal about our interpretation of what's the right diet, what's the right weight for every individual. And I think people find pretty much, if they're really paying attention to it, that they can titrate their intake to their output pretty well.
I'm going to wade in here on this one because I just think people don't understand it, that being your natural weight, and I think that's really what you're saying, like everybody has a natural weight, but I think their natural weight is not what the FDA or these other people have said is normal. If you can lose weight, like I heard some statistic that every pound extra you carry is 7 pounds or 14 pounds of pressure on your knees or something. Is that true to that effect? And losing that weight, that means you're going to put less wear and tear on your existing body, especially as you get older.
So the data is that you take 2 to 3 million steps per year in normal gait, normal walking, and up to 5 times your body weight, depending on the height of the step or the jump or the run. And so if you lose 10 pounds, that can be up to 50 pounds, 2 to 3 million times per year off your joint. So the force reduction is pretty phenomenal as you optimize your weight for your frame. So that's one part of the story. But the other part of the story is what you were alluding to first, is that people have different body weights and different body shapes that work well for them. And listening to your body and assessing what it is you want to do and sort of titrating your body weight and your body food intake to what you want to do is probably the best path towards happiness and towards staying active and feeling good about yourself as almost any other methodology.
I tend to agree with that. I think I'm old enough to have some experience that between the mirror, the scale, and how you feel is the truth.
Yeah.
And if you can manage that and get your head around it, then you can do that. I sort of got us off track, Dr. Stone. You were talking first about the research on the recovery and getting the cells to help to recruit your own stem cells. Are you working on any other research around any other thing that will keep us young or get us back to action faster?
Yes, but I'll answer that in just a sec because I'm going to come back to your scale and your how you feel about yourself.
All right.
There's one other part to that you left out, and that is the distance to the podium. Because it turns out that if you set goals for yourself, and especially if they're goals that are a little bit hard to reach, you reorganize your day, your life, your activities, your attitude around that little bit of competition, that little bit of goal, that little bit of pushing yourself. And I think that's a really important part of that story that you just told. It's not just about how you feel or how you feel you look or what the scale tells you. It's about what do you want to accomplish? What do you want to do with yourself? You're physically, what do you want to do with yourself? Where do you want to be next year? What new sport do you want to play? How do you want to win if winning is your goal, or just compete if competing is your goal, or just whatever your goal is, setting that goal and using that as your podium really changes what you choose to eat, how you choose to feel, how much you exercise, and a whole host of things. So I think people get out of the habit of having those kinds of goals. You outgrew your college team or your club sport later on, and you sort of fell into whatever routine you currently have. And if you can just look around and pick some goals and grab some friends to set those goals together, the social part of goal setting and playing will change your life. And so I'd really encourage people in that space. The other side of your question about other things going on in the foundation. So we've done an awful lot of work on cartilage regeneration. So how do we regrow the damaged cartilage inside your knee or your shoulder or your ankle? And so we developed a technique called articular cartilage paste grafting, where we take bone and cartilage from one part of the knee joint, create a paste out of it, bloody the damaged or arthritic area, and put the paste back in. And we received a $1 million grant this past year from the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine to augment that paste and make it better, make it easier for surgeons around the world to use it and to test to see whether or not we have indeed made it better. And so we're in a host of animal trials right now, because it applies not only to humans, but it applies to working and competitive horses and dogs, which are not only fantastic animals, but they're also extremely expensive and valuable to their owners for a host of reasons. And so, and they have a number of sports and joint injuries. And so the research that we're doing and then testing in animal models will apply to the animals as well, and then will apply to humans. And so we think we can regrow cartilage much better than we have been, even though we've been doing a pretty good job. We think we can do a lot better. And that's the research that we're doing right now.
I'll go back to your comment on the goal setting. I think it's refreshing to actually talk to an orthopedic surgeon who has some part of psychology. I'm saying this lovingly as part of the prescription or the tip, because I think in the old days, older people will probably remember when doctors were more one-dimensional. And the fact that we're even recognizing this now, I think, is a more holistic view. This may sound funny, but on my third surgery, I told Dr. Silberstein that he couldn't say, and nobody in that surgery room could say anything negative, because I was worried. I was working with a sports psychologist who worked with Olympic athletes. In my head, I thought that somebody, like when he saw me at 13, he probably was like, oh my God. I mean, I could be like, this kid's 13. He has an ACL. Oh, he's done. Like, I don't know what somebody said in there, but you could be listening. And I actually had, I played lacrosse in Baltimore. I had my boys' Latin physical. We had a trainer full time. I had him in the surgery to make sure that nothing negative got said. Now, Dr. Silberstein was on the cutting edge, I think, of on the forefront of stuff back then. And, but I think what you said is very, very important, that you could fix everybody's knees or you can fix all these things, but if you don't have that holistic approach, it sort of falls down. So I just wanted to point that out, because I think too often in the past, in my life, doctors had been more one-dimensional in that idea versus, and I think orthopedic surgeons, because you deal with people who are want to be active and you're trying to get this positivity, are more on the forefront there. But I think that's just worth mentioning, Dr. Stone, because it is that holistic approach. And on the regenerating cartilage, that sounds very promising for people who, I'll just say, the arthritis, the pain in the arthritis is a real thing. I've learned to live with it, but living with that then tends to lead to some other negative, I tend to say negative, like you could live on Advil or Aleve, which probably is not recommended.
So the vision for the foundation and the research that we do is to accelerate healing and to treat, prevent, and cure arthritis. And I think that is a vision that we can all work towards and achieve in our lifetimes here. There's quite a number of ways now that we can do all of those things. We just can't do them all well enough, in my view, and fast enough. And that's why I'm driven on the research side. And that's why I spend half my life in the clinic and operating room, and the other half my life on the research side. And I think that that's the fun and the excitement and the optimism about what we're doing and how we're going to help people play forever. And that's our goal.
I can't help but think, though, didn't you have an ACL?
I did. I tore my meniscus cartilage playing soccer back at Harvard in the day. And I was out for a run one day with my mentor at the time, a guy named Dick Stedman, who was Doc for the US ski team. And we worked together. And he said, you know, Kevin, if you could ever figure out how to replace the meniscus, you'd make a real contribution to orthopedics. And I was all of, 23 years old. And so I started on that project back then and have been working on it ever since. We developed the first collagen scaffold for regrowing the meniscus. And then in the mid-90s, I was part of the development team developing new techniques for transplanting patients' cadaver meniscus into people. And we now have 30 years of experience of doing that and lots of good data. And so that whole field of regrowing is and replacing has grown out of my own injuries. And I eventually tore my ACL while skiing in Vail, of course, and had to have that rebuilt as well.
I do want to ask you this, and I know we're focusing on knees, and my wife probably upset because she's got an ankle issue from falling off a horse and shoulder people. But I looked at some meta-analysis on the ACL, and there was some research that said that the outcome of not replacing the ACL people who didn't have it fixed and the people that did, the outcome was basically the same. You could live without the ACL if you, I guess, did weightlifting and things like that. I mean, do you have any opinion on that?
Yep. There are some knees that are ACL dependent knees, meaning without an ACL, they're unstable. They damage their meniscus. They develop arthritis. They're really unhappy knees. And there are other people who are ACL independent knees where they injure their ACL. Either it doesn't heal, but they don't develop much instability, or it heals partially, usually to the PCL, and it gives them just enough stability to be good enough for them. And so examining the knee, you can usually tell how unstable is this knee, and usually not always make a good decision about, is it worth it to just exercise alone? Is it worth it to try to repair the ones that can be surgically repaired? Or is it better to just reconstruct it and replace it? And these days, that's almost always with a donor ligament in our hands. So that decision tree is made by a careful exam, understanding the patient, their own morphology, and their desires. But back to your wife, because I want you to go home happy. A big part of our research has been in ankle arthritis as well, because the ankle almost never develops primary arthritis unless it's injured. So without a fracture or chronic instability, we never see a patient with primary ankle arthritis. And there's something unique about the ankle cartilage. And so when we go back in now and we take these very damaged ankles with bone-on-bone arthritis in the ankle joint, and almost 100% of these patients have been told to either have a fusion or have an ankle joint replacement, and we just open up that joint and graft them, and a fairly large number of these patients have done incredibly well. We can't restore a normal ankle, but we can reduce the pain and improve the motion. So I think the ankle biology and the ankle cartilage is unique. There's something about it that's quite resistant to the development of arthritis without being injured. And it's a whole space that a lot of research will be directed at.
Yeah, well, my wife will be excited. I think she has 7 pins and 3 plates in there from falling off a horse. So I think her, and she does dog agility, which you were talking about, dogs and things like that. Like, that is a big thing. I don't think people understand or realize that, but that, you know, horses, dogs, and all this stuff are experiencing the same type of, maybe differently, but same, it's the same idea behind the joints. And is that true with the shoulder too? Just to address, like, I want to give some love to shoulder people out there before we wrap up here. I mean, the shoulder, does the shoulder have a good outcome too for people?
The shoulder, unfortunately, does not have a good outcome for the arthritis development, meaning once it starts down the arthritis pathway, our tools right now are just PRP and lubrication and exercise, and we don't have great tools for shoulder arthritis. We're getting better and better tools for rotator cuff tears and labral tears, the soft tissue injuries around the shoulder. But I must tell you, the biology of the shoulder, where the ankle is so much more favorable, the shoulder is that much worse. When it starts down that arthritic pathway, it's very challenging to change that course. So shoulders are a little bit behind.
Do you have any feeling real quick on CBD and its ability to reduce pain? I've actually, the only reason I said that is because I have a friend who has a shoulder thing, and he said he takes CBD and it's reduced his pain. Is there any real research around that?
So I don't know that data. I will tell you that about at least a third of our patients post-op are using one of the cannabinoids, whether it's THC or CBD or CBN, and they report that they use far less post-operative pain drugs of any kind. And so these cannabinoid receptors and binding to them is a wonderful space for research. Clearly, kids have done research in that space for hundreds of years. But here on the medical side of it, I think there is real potential for reducing pain, stress, helping people sleep, all those things. We can't yet prescribe it, not federally legal yet, but we hear from our patients, no question, a lot of them are using it.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. As we wrap up here, if you were to have to give 3 pieces of advice to listeners to stay young and preserve their youth and come back from an injury, and you could only give three things from all your research and all your experience, what are those three things?
First of all, keep your head in the game, because the number one cause of sports injuries is a mental error, where you're distracted, you're thinking about your girlfriend or boyfriend, you're on your phone, you're just, your mind just isn't there for that fraction of a second, and you're skiing too fast, you make the wrong turn, you hit the ball wrong, you twist wrong, your head just wasn't there. And so when you're exercising, having your head in the game will markedly reduce your injuries. Number two, if you get injured, make an accurate early diagnosis. Our tools for repairing these tissues now have gotten so good, but you want to get to them when they're freshly injured, if possible, because the success rate goes up quite a bit. A fresh meniscus tear heals so much better than an old one. True of the ACL, true of the rotator cuff, true of the ankle ligaments. And so very early on, get a clear expert exam, get an x-ray and an MRI, find out what the diagnosis is and make a decision about treatment. And then lastly, play forever. I mean, the fun of living, life's short, every decade's precious. Find other ways of playing and having fun and add fun to all of your exercise activities. Forget about working out. Think about playing out and we'll try to help you, and you try to help you. Drop dead at 100 playing some sport you love.
I think those are great. Dr. Stone, where's the best place for listeners to find you?
We're here in San Francisco at the Stone Clinic and stoneclinic.com. Research, if they want to look at that, at stoneresearch.org. And then the book Play Forever is on Amazon. And that's another way of finding out a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today.
Great. We'll put all that in the show notes. Thanks a lot for taking time out of your day to explain a lot of this stuff. I think we are leaving with a lot of optimism on this episode. So thank you for that.
It's my pleasure.
Bye, everyone.